Good evening, Tuesday night Bible study on the book of Acts, written by St. Luke. Tonight we're going to get through about the first half of chapter 7. So if you remember last week, chapter 6, short week, short chapter, we did the whole chapter in one class. And it started out with the Greek-speaking Christians, the Hellenists, were complaining that their widows were being neglected. And that was a big deal. The church was supporting widows. They are one of the more vulnerable people, groups of people within the church, along with children who are very vulnerable. So, 7 men were chosen. They all had Greek names. So, somebody voices an opinion or a complaint, then you turn around and you ask them, would you be willing to address that? They picked 7 men, and including Stephen, which is really the only name that we would recognize. The others we don't know anything about. And then we talked a little bit about, were they ordained or not? That was a question we had in one of my seminary classes. Were they ordained or not? Well, they laid hands on them and they prayed over them. Ooh, that sounds like an ordination. And then soon thereafter, at the end of the chapter, Stephen was preaching and performing healing miracles, signs and wonders. Well, that sounds to me like he was ordained. So this was another group of pastors, you could say, the first group of pastors beyond the apostles were these 7 men. And so Stephen is preaching and performing miracles, and then he's arrested. And they didn't ask him politely to come with him, they just arrested him forcibly. And that's where the chapter ended. And so then here we are in chapter 7, which is the pickup of that continuation, where they're going to interrogate him. Okay? All right, so verse 7, chapter 7, verse 1, the high priest said, are these things so? Well, which things? Let me go backwards to the last couple of verses of chapter 6 real quick, just so we can see what he's talking about. So the end of chapter 6, verse 12, let me start with verse 12. They stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes, and they came upon him and seized him and brought him before the council. So there's where they arrested Stephen. And they set up false witnesses who said, this man never ceases to speak words against this holy place and the law, this holy place being the temple. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and will change the customs that Moses delivered to us. Well, Stephen did say those things, didn't he? Because Jesus did say, destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. But he wasn't talking about the physical temple. He was talking about himself as a temple. And did Jesus proclaim in different ways and at different times that he would be the final sacrifice? Yes. So that changes the customs of Moses, the sacrificial rites. So these false witnesses are partially correct. Stephen did say these things about Jesus, but they're out of context. They're not understanding or applied correctly. And then gazing at him, all who sat in the council saw that his face was like the face of an angel. So he had some kind of glow about him. Appeared to be a little bit supernatural, maybe. All right, so that's what the high priest is talking about. He preached that Jesus would destroy the temple and that Jesus would change the customs or the laws of Moses. Okay? So back to chapter 7, verse 1. And the high priest said, are these things so? And Stephen said, now here we get a nearly chapter-long, I won't call it a lecture, I'm going to call it a sermon. This is a sermon from Stephen. Okay, and what's he say? Brothers and fathers, hear me. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, go out from your land and from your kindred and go into the land that I will show you. Then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans and lived in Haran. And after his father died, God removed him from there into this land in which you are now living. Yet he gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot's length, but promised to give it to him as a possession and to his offspring after him, though he had no child. And God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be sojourners in a land belonging to others, who would enslave them and afflict them 400 years. But I will judge the nation that they serve, said God, And after that, they shall come out and worship me in this place. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham became the father of Isaac, and circumcised him on the eighth day, and Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs. So that's the first paragraph. I'm going to go back and go through it in a little bit more detail. So what's he doing here, first of all? What's this sound like? And he's going to continue doing it in the next couple of paragraphs, too.
Relaying the history, I guess.
Yeah, he's relaying the history of the nation of Israel. Absolutely. So first of all, preparing for this and pondering this a little bit, I think it is important in a culture, in a society, to have a common understanding of your history. If people don't understand history the same way, or argue about what happened in history to the origin of a country, or the origin of a culture, or the origin of a society, you're going to have disagreements on where you are now and where you need to go into the future. You have to have a common understanding of the past. I never really thought that history class in school was that valuable while I was in school. Okay? And then since then, what's that? Yeah.
Good question. Isn't every Jewish kid taught this?
Yeah.
Okay. Every Jewish boy.
Absolutely. And now the girls, too, but back then, the boys, yep. Yep, absolutely. So I came to realize how important history is when maybe in some point along the way in my adult years, you know, I came to interact with people who just didn't seem to understand the history of our own nation or the purpose of the Constitution or what the Declaration of Independence says. And then I start to realize, boy, somebody didn't get through their history class, their American civics or all that. It makes a difference. Because if you don't understand that stuff, you have a different perception of the present and where we need to go in the future, right? Absolutely. So, Stephen is beginning here with the history of the Israel nation. And he's not going to explain everything about the history, but he's going to hit some highlights. And there's a reason he hits certain highlights of their history. Now, he starts out by saying, the God of glory. What was God's name in the Old Testament?
Yahweh.
What was God's name before he gave himself the name Yahweh in the burning bush? What was his name prior to that? How was he referred? Well, I am is Yahweh. Prior to that, he was referred to as the God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's how they would refer to him. Well, what about prior to Abraham? How was God referred to? Hint?
The Father.
The God of glory. It's right there. The God of glory. So from Adam until Abraham, there was a common understanding that God, the true God, is the creator of all things and is the protector of all things and is the watcher of all things. And he is the true God. Now, at the time of Noah, for instance, people stopped believing in the true God or, frankly, just didn't care. Yeah, we know God is out there. We know who the true God is. Yeah, our great-grandfather, you know, Methuselah, he was telling us about it. But, you know, we don't care about God. He's irrelevant, they would think. Or he didn't matter. Or they didn't have to do anything to, you know, worship him or honor him or follow or obey him. But he was referred to by this, the God of glory. So it was a common understanding of a God. Then, by the time of Noah, a lot of people fell into disbelief or just apathy, didn't care. So what did God do at the time of Noah? Well, he started over, wiped out the earth with the flood, and then began again. By the time of Abraham, there were again a slice of humanity that stopped believing in God, the true God. And some of that slice had started making their own false gods, crafting idols. Okay. However, there was still a slice of humanity, a percentage of humanity, that still believed in the true God. Abraham's family was one of those. Okay. So God came to Abraham's family. Actually, it was his father. If you go back and look at the story, God came to Abraham's father and told him to move from Mesopotamia to Haran. Then they lived in Haran for a little while. Abraham's father died, and Abraham was then told by God, probably in a vision, maybe in a dream, we don't know, to move from Haran to Canaan. Okay? Abraham, Abraham just followed God. He said, I know this is still the true God. There is a true God out there. There's a chunk of, you know, spots of humanity that still believe in the true God. Abraham's one of those. So he was obedient. It says in the book of Hebrews, that's how Abraham was righteous, was because he believed God. That was his righteousness. So that righteousness is connected to faith. So Abraham moved from Haran to Canaan. And the Jews all knew this history. So Stephen is starting to recount this, and said to him, Abraham, verse 3, go out from your land and from your kindred and go into the land that I will show you. And he went out from that land, which at this point was Haran, which is still in Mesopotamia, really, in the Fertile Crescent there. And he went to the land of the Chaldeans, that's Canaan. And he, Chaldeans and lived in Haran, and then after his father died, God removed him from there into this land in which you are now living. So one of the things is, the Jewish council has got to be sitting there with their hands on their heads going like, why is he telling us all this? This is something every single one of us already understands. But it's prelude. He's building. Stephen is building up to something. So yes, he's recounting for them their history, which they all understood. And God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be sojourners in a land belonging to others, who would enslave them and inflict them for 400 years. God did say that to Abraham. And what is that a reference to?
Egypt,
yeah, being down in Egypt. But I will judge the nation that they serve, said God, and after that they shall come out and worship me in this place. God said that to Abraham way beforehand. Well, what did happen? What happened? Did God judge Egypt? Oh, yes, in a mighty way, by miraculous deeds. And he brought the Israelites, the Hebrews, out of Egypt back to, what did they call it? The Promised Land, right? And God gave him the covenant of circumcision, so that was a rite or a ritual to verify or validate or remind of this promise that God gave to Abraham. And so Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day, and that's where the Jews circumcised on the eighth day. And Isaac became the father of Jacob, and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs. So Abraham, at the point he receives these promises, has no land, he's a nomad, and he has no heirs, he has no children. What are the two biggest blessings you could receive from God back in that time? I would say even today. Land and children or family. Yes. Two biggest blessings. And both of those, by the way, are, foreshadowing the biggest blessings God will give to us. Will God give you the promised land? Yeah. Will God give to you a family? Yeah. Whether you have one left here on earth or not or whatever, you're going to be part of the family of God in the kingdom of heaven, right? The promised land with surrounded by family. Those are the two biggest blessings. God gave those blessings to Abraham. And Abraham at the time had neither one, so it was a big deal. So this is about, the reason Stephen is mentioning this is he is reminding them of God's grace. God's grace, right here. Yeah, Jeannie?
I think it's important to notice that, you know, these were people who were getting false witnesses who say these things against Stephen, and yet he kept his cool, and he addressed them as brothers and fathers.
That's a good point.
And then rehearsed their common history, like you're telling us.
Yeah.
And finding their unity.
Yes. I think you're absolutely right. That's a good point to remind, to remember. They had set up false witnesses, liars, against him. And he still keeps his cool, and he's trying to draw them in to their common history, to their understanding.
And I think the only way Stephen could do that, or any human could do that, is what we read in the previous chapter. Stephen was a man full of faith,
He was, absolutely, full of faith in the Holy Spirit. That is how he was empowered to do this, to keep his cool, and then to start this sermon. I'm going to call it a sermon. You could call it a lecture if you want, I guess. Okay? So that's the first paragraph there. That's Stephen kind of setting up their common history and reminding them of God's grace to the whole nation of Israel through the grace that God gave, the covenant God gave to Abraham, the promised land and the family, the heirs, the offspring. Okay? All right? Everybody with me? Any other questions or comments, observations? All right, next paragraph. I'm going to read the whole paragraph and then come back and look at it a little bit more. Verse 9, and the patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt. But God was with him and rescued him out of all his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who made him ruler over Egypt and over all his household. Now there came a famine throughout all Egypt and Canaan and great affliction, and our fathers could find no food. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out our fathers on their first visit. And on the second visit, Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And Joseph's family became known to Pharaoh. And Joseph sent and summoned Jacob his father and all his kindred, 75 persons in all. And Jacob went down into Egypt, and he died, he and our fathers. And they were carried back to Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham had bought for a sum of silver from the sons of Hamor in Shechem. The only land that Abraham had ownership to was a burial plot that he bought from the local Canaanites. Okay? That was it. They owned no other land themselves otherwise. So, you recognize this history. Again, common history. All the Jews would know it. Frankly, all of us Christians know it. It's a biblical history. And it's all about what? The brothers were jealous of Joseph. Israel was, Jacob was playing favorites. He shouldn't have been. That, you know, there's sin in the patriarchs and all of the apostles, David, all the rest. They all have sin. Jacob was playing favorites. He shouldn't have been. The other brothers were jealous of Joseph. So what did they do? Sold him into slavery. And then they took his coat of many colors. Joseph and the Technicolor Dream Coat. Isn't that wonderful? Something like that there. Took the coat and dipped it in goat's blood and said, you know, is this your son's coat? Oh, he must have been eaten by an animal. And so they lied. Sold their brother into slavery. So were they sinful? Yes. Was Jacob sinful? Yes. Was Joseph sinful? I would say yes. He was kind of bragging over his brothers. Oh, I had a dream. You guys are all going to bow down to me. You don't have to poke the bear. You know, that's what you're doing. So there's a lot of sin in here. Disobedience. I'm going to call it disobedience or rebellion. And yet, what did God do? Here's that word again. Grace. God showed great grace. He favored Joseph. Joseph rose. We all know those stories. Stephen doesn't go into the details here. But Joseph rose to prominence, became the second in command of Egypt, and through Joseph, the entire family was rescued from famine. So even though Jacob, the sons of Jacob, Joseph himself were all disobedient and rebellious and sinful, yet God showed grace to them and redeemed them, saved them. Okay? That's the point here of this paragraph. You see that in there? You're going to see that theme repeating in the next two paragraphs as well. Yeah, Rich?
Yeah, actually, the disciples wanted to kill Joseph, but Reuben saved his life.
Yeah, that's true.
In turn, saved their lives.
Correct. You're right. The brothers wanted to kill him, and Reuben saved him. You're right. Said, no, let's not kill him. He's our brother. Let's just sell him into slavery. Is that better? Well, yeah, it's probably better than being killed.
No, I don't think it was Reuben that suggested it.
Or Judah.
He wanted to come back and rescue him.
Yeah, you're right.
But it's ironic that he ended up saving their lives.
He did. Joseph ended up saving all their lives. Yep. And there's also a reference here to 75 persons. So the clan, the family, had grown to 75 people. And there's also a reference to Abraham actually owning a little sliver of land, a burial plot, in the promised land. I think there's some representation there for us as well. Do you own a little sliver of heaven? You have a little sliver of heaven. You can even call it a burial plot. When you're buried, where will you be after that? In the promised land, in heaven. You're given that little bit of inheritance. I'm kind of babbling now. I hadn't thought about this. Can we think of our burial plot as an inheritance? As a little bit of foreshadowing of heaven? Yeah, I guess we probably could. This is not in my notes. That's just all of a sudden the Holy Spirit. Yeah, why not? We each have our own little burial plot that is a foreshadowing of heaven, just like Abraham had here. All right. Let's see, anything else to bring up there? Some of silver from the sons of Hamor in Shechem. Yeah. Okay. Other thoughts or comments? Oh, Jeannie.
Both with Abraham and with Isaac and Jacob, it says, but God was with him. And like you said, some of the best blessings can be land and children. I don't have either. I won't. I do have a burial plot.
There you go. You're like Abraham. You're like Abraham.
Actually, my parents had one. There's half one still there. My three sisters and I have to work things out. But anyway, but God was with them. That's the common thing.
Yes, it is. That's right.
God was leading Abraham, and they had faith in him.
They did.
And that's why this worked.
That is why it's worked. That it worked. Yes. Abraham is considered righteous in multiple places, including Hebrews and elsewhere, because of his faith. Not because of his actions or his works. Yes. It was all about faith. Right. Okay. Next paragraph. Verse 17. But as the time of the promise drew near, which God had granted to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt until there arose over Egypt another king who did not know Joseph. So I'm going to actually pause here for a minute. As the time of the promise drew near, God's promise of letting Abraham have the promised land. Okay? So up until now, Stephen is reminding them that for a while, for some generations, the Israelites enjoyed plenty and honor and, you know, high stature in Egypt. But what happened? There arose over Egypt another king who did not know Joseph. I seem to remember from outside the Bible, not inside the Bible, extra Bible, biblical history of the ancient world, that there was a changing of the guard, so to speak, that the Egyptian pharaoh and his family, his sons, were overthrown, were deposed, and a new pharaoh came in and assumed control. So it was a new dynasty, as you would say in royalty relationships, you know, a different dynasty of kings in England or in France. Well, a new dynasty began in Egypt. And that with that new dynasty, of course, if you were connected to the old pharaoh, you're on the outs, right? I don't want you a part of my group. You're a slave now. Yeah, you were an advisor before. Now you're a slave. Boy, things can change quickly, right? Yeah. All right, so verse 18 there. Until there arose over Egypt another king who did not know Joseph. He dealt shrewdly with our race and forced our fathers to expose their infants so that they would not be kept alive. At this time, Moses was born, and he was beautiful in God's sight. And he was brought up for 3 months in his father's house. And when he was exposed, Pharaoh's daughter adopted him and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and deeds. So again, here's a case of misfortune falling upon God's people. I wouldn't say maybe so much rebellion and disobedience here, but for sure, misfortune. And that enveloped Moses as well, because the new dynasty, the new pharaoh, he was afraid of the Israelites, right? They were growing too numerous, too powerful, you know, in terms of numbers and strength. So he started telling them, well, you have to kill the babies so that these people don't keep growing like this. Wow. That would be awful. And Moses, so of course, Stephen doesn't go into the details, just hitting some highlights here. So again, what is he pointing to? The misfortune of the Israelites, but the grace and salvation of God. The grace and salvation of God. Okay? By the way, and Moses then grew up in Pharaoh's own household. By the way, let me back up slightly and also point out, you know what, I'm going to finish. I'm going to keep going. Then I'm going to back up. I have another point to make about all of this. Okay?
Yes, I have a question. In this, they say he was mighty in his words and deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he was at the burning bush, he said he couldn't do it because he was slow of speech, right?
Yeah.
He stuttered.
Right. Yeah. That's a difference of perception. The others perceived him. He is perceived by Jewish historians as being mighty of words and deeds. But he himself did not perceive himself that way. Yeah.
Well, you don't have someone who's a spokesman. You know, Aaron was his.
Well, Aaron became his spokesman, right?
So it's his words through Aaron.
Yeah. And frankly, part of it too, we might blame this a little bit on Moses, so that the rest of the Jewish community saw Moses as mighty in words and deeds, and Moses may have just been, no, I don't want to do it. No, God, I'm slow of tongue. I don't want to do it. Well, was he really slow of tongue? Maybe a little bit. He was a stutterer or whatever, but he could have done it, but he just didn't want to, so he made an excuse. So that's a problem with Moses too, right? Yeah. Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his words and deeds. Okay, so the paragraph is again about misfortune, or not in this case disobedience, but misfortune, and then God's grace and salvation. Okay? You see a theme there. All right, here we go again. Same theme. Next paragraph. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel. So he still knew he was a Jew, even though he's brought up as an Egyptian in the Pharaoh's household. And seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptian. Ooh, I would say there was a sin against Moses. He shouldn't have done that. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand, but they did not understand. And on the following day, he appeared to them as they were quarreling and tried to reconcile them, saying, "Men, you are brothers. Why do you wrong each other?" But the man who was wronging his neighbor thrust him aside, saying, "Who made you a ruler and judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" At this retort, Moses fled and became an exile in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. Okay? So again, there's Moses probably going overboard. Killing an Egyptian, that's not, in any culture, that's not the right form of justice. He was taking justice into his own hands. And then God kind of rescued him out of that by sending him into exile. Well, he had to flee. He went into the land of Midian. Yeah, that was actually salvation. Because he was now on the bad side of his own countrymen, the Jews. They viewed him in a poor way, with a poor reputation. You know, as well, you grew up in Pharaoh's house, and now you're pretending to be judge over us? You're going to kill me like you killed that Egyptian? That was wrong on the part of the Jews, but it was also wrong on the part of Moses. So God gave Moses some salvation by removing him from that situation. Okay? Yeah, Joyce?
So did the Jews know that he was a Jew at this time?
Yes.
And he killed the Egyptian?
They yes.
Did. Okay.
They did. Yeah. Which, again, you know, he's trying to defend his countrymen. Well, he did it the wrong way. You don't kill the Egyptian who's oppressing them. But then his brothers, yeah, they accused him wrongly. He was trying to do what was right. Yeah, Jeannie.
Could it be that before, when he was being trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, that's when he was an excellent speaker and a man of action? And now when this happened, and he knew the Jews could turn him in to the Egyptians, that he lost that courage and his old life.
Well, I suppose that's possible. I never thought about that.
And that's why later on,
So, yeah, he might have been more eloquent in his speaking as he was being trained and educated in the Pharaoh's household. Yeah, that's possible. And then he lost his courage here. He goes and scatters away and, he self-proclaims himself as being slow of tongue. Yeah, right. That's possible. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good idea. That's a good thought.
The whole experience would have humbled him.
Oh, yes, it would have humbled him. Absolutely. Yes. Yes, I totally think that is true. It changed Moses' attitude. Because put yourself in the shoes of Moses right here. He's thinking to himself, I'm trying to help my fellow man. He was being oppressed by that Egyptian. And so I defend my fellow man, and then my fellow man, my brothers, they turn on me and accuse me of being judge over them, and accuse me wrongly of I'm going to kill them. No. So Moses is frustrated, for sure, perhaps a little bit perplexed, no doubt second-guessing his own thoughts and actions, what should he have done? And all of that leads to his fleeing. He goes into Midian. And that's where he finds a wife and has two sons. Right? So God blessed him there. God gave him a place to live and family and offspring. Okay, other thoughts or questions? All right. One more paragraph. I think that's as far as we will go today. But then, after this paragraph, I'm going to go back and point out something to you in each of these paragraphs. The greater point that Stephen is making. All right. Verse 30. Now when 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in a flame of fire in a bush. When Moses saw it, he was amazed at the sight. And as he drew near to look, there came the voice of the Lord. I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. See, there's the name that they referred to God before God gave himself a name. And Moses trembled and did not dare to look. Then the Lord said to him, take off your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their groaning, and I have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt. Okay? So there's the commissioning of Moses. I'm going to stop there. So there's the commissioning of Moses. We don't get all the details. We don't hear about Moses saying, well, who will speak for me? Well, I'll send Aaron, your brother, to speak for you. And he says, well, what sign shall I have? And throw it on your staff, and it'll become a snake, and pick it up, and it's a staff again. You know, who shall I say sent me? Tell them I am sent you. None of those details. So why, again, is Stephen highlighting certain aspects of Jewish history only? This is where I want to go back and point out something to you. So all the way back here, starting with Abraham, Abraham is a representative, a foreshadowing of the Messiah. Oh, there you now, you know, I just gave it away, just like that. So, Abraham believed God, did what he said, was obedient, and that gave him righteousness. That's a foreshadowing of the coming Messiah, okay? And then Joseph was, persecuted, I guess you could say, yeah, persecuted by his brothers, and yet ended up being the salvation of his brothers. Well, what does that point to? Well, that points to the Messiah as well, the coming Savior. Was Jesus persecuted and then ended up saving his fellow humans? All of humanity, really. Yes, so Joseph is a Christ figure also, just like Abraham. And then Moses. Moses is born, and he is exposed, but yet rescued. So, does that remind us of Jesus when he was born? The babies were being killed, but Jesus was rescued by going where? A dream was given to Joseph, Jesus' father, to flee and go to where? Egypt? Yes, there's a connection there. All of the Sanhedrin and the high priests that are listening to this, they know all of this history. They're making these connections. Stephen is highlighting points of Jewish history, of Israel history, that point to the coming Messiah. You see where this is going. because then he's going to reiterate what he's already said. Jesus is that Messiah. Oh, and they won't like that. So, yes, Moses is another Christ-like figure. And was Jesus instructed in wisdom? Yes. Was he mighty in his words and deeds? Yes. So Moses is foreshadowing Jesus right there as well. And then, oh, by the way, and here's another little side note. It says, not the next paragraph. Sorry, I'm ahead of myself. So then he flees. So Jesus had to flee. Where did he flee from? He fled from Jerusalem up to Galilee. He was in danger down in Jerusalem because his own countrymen were against him, the high priests and the Pharisees, Sadducees. So he did the vast majority of his ministry, he lived in Galilee, right? More distant. So kind of like Moses fleeing out of the area. But then Jesus came back and rescued them all. So again, Moses is still a Christ-like figure. And then when 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in a flame of fire in the bush. Well, I think this is also a case of who is it that's talking to Moses out of the bush? This says an angel. Well, that comes from Exodus. So where in Exodus is that? I kind of forgot. Exodus chapter 3, maybe, something like that. I'm going to go there and look at that story real quick because I want to make a point to it for you. The burning bush. Oh, I got it right. Hey. Yes, this is it. This is what I was looking for. So Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses was keeping the flock with his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. By the way, priest of Midian. His father-in-law Jethro was still a believer in the true God. That's something we often overlook. Okay? And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. That mountain comes up over and over again, multiple times. And what does verse 2 say? And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. Does it say an angel?
No.
The angel. What's the difference between the and a? Those are both articles in the English language. One is a definite article, and the other one is an indefinite article. So I'm going to make we're going to have a little grammar lesson back in school, okay? How many of you like English and grammar?
Raise your hand.
Oh, well, more of you than I thought. Well, good for you guys. So if I say, here's an apple, a apple, an apple, and if I say, here is the apple, what's the difference?
What's specific?
Specific! The apple. I'm referring to this specific apple for some reason. Versus an apple or a apple. I mean, an with the vowel and all that. An apple, you're saying this is just one among many.
Yeah, that's just like
a
Ohio State.
Yeah, there you go. That's very true. Yeah, that annoys me too. The Ohio State, yeah. Jill and I have to start saying the University of Michigan to get back at those Ohio State people. So I had a seminary professor who did his dissertation. Actually, it was Dr. Charles Geeshan who preached my ordination, if any of you remember him. Some of you were here at my ordination back 15 years ago. One of my more favorite seminary professors. His dissertation and completely convinced me. I'm in complete agreement with him. He sold me just looking through his... I didn't even read the whole thing. I just... The angel of the Lord is a reference multiple places in the Old Testament. He made the case, I think very convincingly, that that's a reference to the pre-incarnate Jesus. Okay? Jesus is the angel of the Lord. There are other places in the Old Testament where it says an angel of the Lord. In those cases, it was probably Michael or Gabriel or one of the others. Okay? So, there's lots of references of angels in the Old Testament. But if you see the angel of the Lord, that's Jesus, pre-incarnate, before he took on human flesh. All right? I totally believe that. However, That is not official LCMS doctrine, okay? Even though a seminary professor did his PhD dissertation on it, it's not been accepted into official doctrine, doctrinal teaching of the LCMS. But I think it's true. Yeah, Jeannie.
I think it should be. And both this reference, Old Testament and the new one in Acts, talk about the angel of the Lord appearing in a flame of fire.
Yeah. That's right. And the Israelites, throughout the time of the Old Testament, even into the New Testament, they associated God's presence, the manifestation of his presence, with either a cloud or fire, based on their wanderings in the wilderness, absolutely. So, yes.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I know in Greek, the word angel, angelos, means messenger.
Yeah.
That's
a good question. I've never looked it up. I'd have to look it up. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Yes, in Greek, angel means messenger. I'm going to guess it means the same in Hebrew. If you wanted to wait after class with me for a minute, I'll go and look it up in my Hebrew dictionary, if you want. All right, back to where we were, Acts chapter 7. All right. So, down here, where were we where that came up? There it is, verse 30. Now, when 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him. That's a translation issue. I think it should be the angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai, in a flame of fire in the bush. Moses saw it. He was amazed at the sight. The reason I bring up that whole issue about a angel versus the angel is because Stephen is hitting highlights of Jewish history, that particular highlights that point to the coming Messiah. Okay? So the burning bush, I truly believe that was Jesus speaking out of that burning bush. Okay? Because it said, the angel of the Lord. So that was Jesus. Now, I'm not going to stake my my life and career on it, but I do think that was the case. The ha is the word. If that word is absent, then it's a or an angel. So the indefinite article is present by having the absence of the definite article in Greek. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Andy.
In the study Bible here, it talks about, it says angel of the Lord, it says messenger of Yahweh, used 63 times. Generally, an angel is a created being who speaks for the Lord, but in many Old Testament studies, the angel of the Lord and the Lord are used interchangeably. This signals an appearance of God's Son before his incarnation.
Hey, is that from the Lutheran Study Bible?
Yeah.
Where is that?
On page 1227.
So that's in between what book?
In Jeremiah, because it says Old Testament names of God.
Jeremiah. So there's a study note within the book of Jeremiah in the Lutheran Study Bible that validates what I just said. Hooray! Thank you, Andy.
Well, it could have been written by Keeshan.
Maybe that study note was written by Dr. Keeshan. It could have been. He was a contributor to the Lutheran Study Bible. All right. Very good. Thank you. That's wonderful. I will use that tomorrow. So, Jeremiah chapter what? Where is that? I'll have to bring my study Bible with me.
11.
Jeremiah 11? Okay. The names of Yahweh, huh? Or Jehovah.
Old Testament names of God.
Okay, very good. All right, so here we are. Moses is speaking to the burning bush, and I have seen their affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their groaning, and I have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt. So this is, I would say, Jesus sending Moses to be a foreshadowing of his own salvation, that when Jesus would bring salvation. So he's sending Moses to be the redeemer of God's people in Egypt. Okay? So all of this is about foreshadowing or pointing from the Israelites' history to the coming Messiah. Well, that's the point he's going to make here. So I think That's about halfway through the... Well, I don't know. Could we do one more paragraph, I suppose? We got a little bit of time. Yes? No?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Verse 35. This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge?" This man, God sent as both ruler and redeemer. See right there, this is Stephen talking still. He's referring to Moses as the redeemer of God's people in Egypt. This man, God sent as both ruler and redeemer by the hand of the angel. There it is, correct. Of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. This man led them out, performing wonders and signs in Egypt and at the Red Sea and in the wilderness for 40 years. So he just glosses over all of the plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea, which do have great symbolism in the Jewish history as well as Christian history, but he glosses over them because he's hitting highlights that point to the Messiah. This is the Moses who said to the Israelites, "God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brothers." Moses did say that. As he was about to die, as he was forbidden to go into the Holy Land, the Promised Land, because why? He sinned. He was disobedient. So God said, "You shall not enter the Promised Land." And then the people were proclaiming, "Well, what about us? What's going to happen?" And Moses was giving them comfort. He said, "God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brothers." That's a near exact quote from what he said back in the book of Exodus. Okay? What was Moses referring to? Ultimately, Christ. Most importantly, Christ. Now, he was referring to that God will keep sending you prophets. So I'm a prophet who's here to help you through, to lead you through, to give you God's word. God will send you more prophets like me from among your brothers. But most importantly, the most important prophet, the coming Messiah. So yes, Moses right here is referring to the Messiah. And the Jews that Stephen is speaking to, they knew this was a reference to the Messiah. They knew that. Yeah, Jeannie?
It jumps out to me that in this last paragraph that you just read, Stephen kept referring to Moses as, "This is the man," and he said again, "the man." And he's talking to people who basically had put Moses on the highest pedestal there could be, next to God.
Yeah.
And that they were using their worship of Moses to criticize Christ and Stephen and any followers.
Yes, yes.
And he's saying, the man, the man, and the prophet God will raise up after me.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. The Jews held Moses in very high regard. He was the giver of God's law. He was the redeemer of God's people out of Egypt. He was one of the great prophets, if not the greatest prophet, in their eyes. And so Stephen is pointing out, here's the man, the prophet, the prophet whom you most adore or uphold, and yet Moses is pointing to a future prophet, a future Messiah, who he's about to link to Jesus. So you see what Stephen is doing here in this lecture, in this sermon. He's pointing highlights that point to the coming Messiah, and then he's about to just say, and this Messiah is Jesus, and oh, they won't like that. So, this is the Moses who said to the Israelites, "God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brothers." Verse 38 then. This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness with the angel who spoke to him at Mount Sinai and with our fathers. He received living oracles to give to us. Moses, he's talking about. Stephen is referring to Moses. Received living oracles to give to us. There's a reference to the Ten Commandments. Our fathers refused to obey him, Moses, but thrust him aside. And in their hearts, they turned to Egypt, saying to Aaron, "Make for us gods who will go before us. As for this Moses, who led us out from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And they made a calf in those days and offered a sacrifice to the idol and were rejoicing in the works of their hands. But God turned away and gave them over to the worship, to worship the host of heaven, as it is written in the book of the prophets. You know, I should probably stop there because I don't know that we have time to go into the rest of that. So again, he's pointing, Stephen is pointing to Moses as the Redeemer. Because the people are rejecting Moses. Why did they do the calf? Why did they ask Aaron to mold a calf, a golden calf for them? You remember the story. They were impatient. Where's Moses? He's been gone for 40 days up on that mountain. Where is he? Maybe God has abandoned us. Aaron, make for us an idol. Well, Aaron really screwed up his leadership, right? He was vice president at the time, and that completely failed.
Right.
So he said, oh, okay, I'll make you an idol. Well, that was stupid. Shouldn't have done that. So this again is pointing to Moses as the Redeemer. Moses is going to come down and redeem them from this false worship. All of this is pointing towards the coming Messiah. And so if you just skim down, we'll get into this in 2 weeks when we finish. He talks about their false worship here, and that they wandered in the wilderness, and yet God made a temple, and then he yells at them, you stiff-necked people, which of your prophets did your fathers not persecute? And then he brings down the righteous one. He refers to Jesus, the coming of the righteous one. That's the Messiah. And then he links that coming Messiah to Jesus. He says, this is Jesus. And boy, they immediately turn on him. And then we hear about the stoning of Stephen, okay, who we would claim is the first martyr, although is he really? So that's what's coming. So just a little preview of the coming, the rest of the chapter. Okay? So quite a sermon, quite a lecture from Stephen, reiterating their own history, which they all knew in common, but pointing out highlights that point to the coming to Jesus, and then he's going to make the connection between. They all believed in the coming Messiah. They just didn't. The high priests, the Sadducees, and Pharisees didn't believe that the Messiah was Jesus. That was their problem. Stephen is making the point that Jesus is the Messiah. And they don't like him for it. They don't like Stephen for pointing that out. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to wrap it up there. We're just right about in an hour. So, questions or comments?
Pastor, I think Stephen did just the way they instructed Jewish kids for centuries. You know, he made the story and instructed them, this is why we do this.
Sure.
And this is what, you know, and the Christ was here with us. Wait a minute, you guys.
Right.
Yeah. Messed it up.
Exactly. Right. All right. How many of you are cooking your own turkey? How many of you are not? Well, you go over to someone else's house and they cook the turkey, right? Yeah, that's us. Actually, Jill and I and our family will be having two turkeys. One at lunchtime and one at dinner time. One side of the family, then the other side of the family. Hopefully I can stay awake for the football game. All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good night, and happy Thanksgiving.